Well, the tape's rolling, mate, so whenever you're ready.
I'm ready. And we begin. Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. Time for another edition of Crave, a podcast about music, films, anything else which has been entertaining Steve McCabe and myself of late.
Now, we're going to be looking this week at Hail Caesar, which is the vastly over-punctuated new release from the Coen brothers.
We've been to see Grimsby, Sacha Baron Cohen's latest opinion splitter, as we'll find out.
It certainly has split opinions, hasn't it?
Yes.
And we've also been talking to the stars of Waiting in the Sky, which is an upcoming tribute to David Bowie.
And these are local New Zealand stars, by the way, and that's been a real treat for Steve and I the last week. But we should start, I guess, with some films.
We shall indeed. Hail Caesar.
Yes.
Are you a Coen Brothers fan, Simon?
I was actually interested to sort of go back and have a little bit of a look at what they've done, and they've churned out a lot of movies with various roles, but in terms of the films that they're most often associated with, some of the early ones I saw, like Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, I remember seeing that. I really enjoyed Fargo. I thought that was great.
I don't think I've ever met anyone who didn't enjoy Fargo.
Yeah, yeah. Big Lebowski was good.
Yep.
And I really liked No Country for Old Men, mm-hmm. Having read the book as well. And I even quite liked their remake of True Grit a year or two back. I thought that was pretty cool. I have to say, Steve McCabe, I didn't quite connect with Hail Caesar.
And yet you clearly went in with a degree of affection for the filmmakers.
Yes, yes. And it was a slow start for me. Just a quick scene setting. This is early 1950s Hollywood. It's a film about the big studio system. It's set in the McCarthy era of a fervent anti-communism sweeping across the United States. And the central character in the film is played by Josh Brolin, an actor I quite like, actually. He plays he's a Mr. Fix-It type guy in the studio, and he's beset with all sorts of dramas. The chief problem for him is, if you've seen the trailer, is one of the big stars, played by George Clooney, is kidnapped.
And it's worth mentioning, incidentally, that Eddie Mannix, Josh Brolin's character, is in fact based on a real-life studio fixer named Eddie Mannix.
Aha. Uh-huh. I think that it sounds like they've done a bit of research on this and drawn out. A number of their characters seem to be based on real people of the day.
Yes.
So this is there are some very big names. I mentioned Josh Brolin and George Clooney. Ralph Fiennes pops up, Jonah Hill, Scarlett Johansson, Frances McDormand, Tilda Swinton, Channing Tatum. It's a big, impressive cast. It's a fairly, it's a very tightly scripted, well thought out film. It's a comedy, but I don't know, what do you think, Steve? I kind of didn't care enough about it as much as I thought I should.
Well, what I noticed is you did the obvious quick rundown of the plot.
Yes.
As one does at the start of a film review. And it took you half a sentence. And I think that's what that is. If I personally really enjoyed the film. But I think if there's going to be a problem with it, it's the fact that the plot itself is nothing but a frame on which to hang lots of lovely little vignettes and beautiful characters, wonderfully scripted scenes. But this whole business of George Clooney's character Baird Whitlock being kidnapped while he's in the middle of producing a swords and sandals epic, you know, he plays the entire film dressed in a Roman centurion's outfit.
Yes,
it's wonderful, and George Clooney is somewhat wasted, to be fair. He doesn't really get a whole lot to do. The real heavy lifting is done by Josh Brolin.
Yes,
Scarlett Johansson plays a character who, frankly, you could take her out of the story and not lose anything.
Yeah, that's true. But actually, there's a number of these big names, Steve, who pop up extremely briefly. Channing Tatum, here's a big dance scene. I like to say that guy can dance.
That song and dance scene, it's obviously a pastiche of South Pacific.
It's great. I'll come back to that. But Jonah Hill is... I think he's there for one scene, isn't he? I think.
And it's a scene that's in the trailer. So if you've seen the trailer, you've seen the entire of Jonah Hill's contribution. And yet his photo is in the posters.
Yes, Frances McDormand is another actor who we barely see. So,
but I don't think the Coen brothers are capable of making a film without her, to be fair.
Yes. I did enjoy Ralph Fiennes' take as a sort of a British European director having to deal with the...
Lawrence Lorentz, yes.
He was good. I enjoyed that.
There is one scene that's in another trailer which is just one of the most glorious scenes you'll ever see in a film like this, where he's trying to train Alden Ehrenreich's character, Hobie Doyle, who starts off as a hick cowboy actor who's suddenly thrust into a high society film, and he's training him to say the line, "Would that it were so simple."
Oh, that's it. Yeah, fantastic.
And it's a scene that goes nowhere. It goes absolutely nowhere, but it gets some of the best laughs in the entire film. That's the kind of film it is.
Yeah, it's kind of a film, it's pretty a navel gazer, isn't it, if you're involved in Hollywood. And it's a lot of in humour, and it's cleverly put together, but I don't think it's going to stay with me as long as some of their other works, like No Country for Old Men or Fargo. I think it just felt, the story didn't drive it along enough, because because you knew it was a bit of a piss take, for want of a better word, the drama didn't really matter.
No, it didn't. I mean, George Clooney spends his entire film looking like Buzz Lightyear. He's not taking it seriously. He's having enormous fun making this film. You can tell.
Yes.
You know, Frances McDormand is there for the briefest of moments, and then she buggers off. You describe it as, now, what was the phrase you used? Navel gazing. Mm. I was going to go with a love letter to the 1950s in Hollywood. But clearly, whichever way you want to look at it, it's very knowing. It's very it knows what it's doing. It's clearly nodding to the 1950s, and the more of a fan you are of that kind of era, I think the more you're going to get out of this film. You're going to start picking up references. The George Clooney character playing the film Hail Caesar was very obviously meant to be John Wayne in the greatest story ever told.
Okay.
Oh yes, I mean that it's clearly a nod to that. But there's so much of it was completely dispensable. I mean, Scarlett Johansson's character didn't need to be there, other than the fact that we got to see Scarlett Johansson in a mermaid costume. And that in itself is worth having Scarlett Johansson in a film for, quite frankly. but the character, as I say, as with Jonah Hill, could have been completely removed from the film.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have gone anywhere. The whole business with Hobie Doyle and Lawrence Lorentz, despite being absolutely exquisite to watch, was utterly dispensable.
Yeah, it's all these little sidebars everywhere.
Yes.
And which is nice. Yeah, it's nice. It's diverting, and it was clever. And I'm not sure if the whole came together in a meaningful way for me anyway. Although I think you put your finger on something, Stephen. You said love letter, because one of the key threads here running through the story, and not to give too much away, is the fact that our Mr. Fix-It, Josh Brolin, is being tempted with a fantastic job offer to leave Hollywood and go off into the real world. And so in many ways, that's one of the most important, I guess, threads running through the film. What is it about this crazy world of movie stars and long hours and the stresses and strains that draws people and makes it apparently a wonderful place to live in and work in? And I guess that's really what it's about.
Though I think you're absolutely right. It's interesting that detail you're talking about, this thread of him being teased away from this frivolous frippery of filmmaking to go and work in the real world, is one of the few threads that actually runs all the way through the film.
Yes, it does. You're right. Yep.
I think we need to make a quick mention, by the way, to Tilda Swinton.
Oh, yeah. She's great.
She's absolutely barking. I have a large fondness for Tilda Swinton. I always have. But she plays two characters.
Yes.
She plays presumably identical twins. It's never explicitly stated.
Yeah.
But she plays Thora and Thessaly Thacker, who are... One of them's English, one of them's American. Don't ask me which is which, because I couldn't tell you.
No, I can't remember.
And if you called either Thora or Thessaly a gossip columnist to her face, they would probably beat you to death with their handbags. But that's basically what those characters are. And they're constantly the Greek chorus who's always chiming in trying to give Josh Brolin a hard time. It's absolutely brilliant. I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it if only for the one scene toward the start of the film where they have, now if I can get this correct, a priest, a rabbi, a Greek Orthodox patriarch, and a Methodist minister.
Yes, that was
around a conference table trying to decide if the theology of Hail Caesar is acceptable. And quite frankly, I'd say that this film is worth the price of admission, if only for that scene.
Excellent. Yeah, I don't want to diss it too much, but I guess perhaps I had really high expectations after some of their previous work. It didn't quite reach the heights for me. But I'm not saying don't go see it by any means. By the way, Josh Brolin, just a quick word on him. I thought he was really great in another one. He has also appeared in another one of their films. He was in No Country for Old Men.
Right.
And he was in another film I really enjoyed last year, Sicario, a sort of drug thriller type thing set on the US-Mexico border.
Yes, I remember you speaking very highly of that one.
Yeah, and he was good in that too. So I'm getting to quite like his work. Right. Phew. Okay,
So tell us, would you recommend that we buy a ticket for that?
Yes, more yes than no. 60% yes, there you go.
I think that's largely coming for your lingering affection for the Coens, really, than for the film itself, perhaps.
Perhaps.
But I have to say, unqualified, absolutely. I was very, very impressed.
Good. I'm glad. It's nice that we don't always see eye to eye, Steve. Which I think might apply...
Speaking of which...
yes, to this next film... Okay, we're talking about Grimsby.
Film by Sacha Baron Cohen. Now, again, I think we need to set this up, as we did with the Cohen brothers, because it's made by what we shall say is a very singular talent.
That's a fair thing to say, yes.
Now, were you a fan walking in?
Okay, there's two parts to my views walking in. My memories of Borat are still very strong, and I think he achieved something really special with that. For some reason, the trailers of the next big one, which was, I've even forgot the name, but they're set in the fashion industry.
That would be Bruno.
Bruno. I didn't actually go and see Bruno. For some reason, I didn't want to see it. I don't know why. So I was hoping, are we going to reach the heights of Borat, or am I going to be a little disappointed? I guess that's... best way I can try and sum it up. What about you? What were your expectations?
Well, I saw Borat and howled with laughter all the way through it.
Yes, yes.
I started watching Bruno, mm-hmm. and I walked out. I thought it was appallingly dreadful. I enjoyed The Dictator,
mm-hmm.
and I also was a fan a long time ago of Ali G, one of his very first characters. I remember laughing very, very hard, especially if you ever get the chance to see Ali G Goes to Northern Ireland. It's painfully funny.
Okay.
But, like I say, his output's been patchy. When he's good, he's phenomenal. When he's bad, he's just reaching.
Yeah, okay, that's a wonderful word, that last word, Steve, for me. I felt he was reaching in this film. This did not work for me at all. I spent a lot of this time in this film not laughing. I did laugh on a couple of occasions. There's one particularly outrageous scene we've been asked not to comment on specifically, and we won't, but it certainly is a scene which would be up there with the sort of the cringing, squirming type of feeling you had in Borat. But the story of a working-class, beer-swilling, football-loving bloke from Grimsby, not particularly educated, who just he and his wife make a lot of children, somehow becomes a James Bond. There've been so many takes on, you know, parodies of that sort of secret agent spy thing that this just didn't fly for me at all. I'm sorry.
But to be fair, I'm trying to defend it here. I'm struggling, really. There's some set pieces in it that are hysterical.
Yes, there are.
You mentioned the film that we're not allowed to talk about to protect the film's shock value, and so we'll respect that. But there's scenes where, for example, there's discussion of how to successfully flush a toilet. Let's just leave it there, shall we? That is painfully funny. There's the closing sequence, the big denouement, if you will, or even if you won't, of the film. Again, it's funny, and there's an awful lot of extraordinarily laddish, very let's see how much shock value we can wring out of this humour that a lot of the time has you laughing while looking, you know, like sort of peering from between your fingers.
I didn't. I'm sorry. I just didn't. You know why I didn't? Because I know that that's what he's trying to do before I go to see this film. That's where he wants to take me. He wants to try and make me square in my seat. And so for it to be successful, he's got to come up with a character that I will want to invest in some way. And I think what he did in Borat is he took an outrageous character, but he it was the fish out of water, wasn't it, Steve? From Kazakhstan to the United States. And you just didn't know at times whether he was talking to real people. Was it like almost like a doco? Were they actors? What was going on? We really felt for these other people. But here, I think the transformation from the Grimsby lad to this other sort of person, I just didn't feel that was at all, not that it should be believable, but it didn't take me along with it at all. I found his accent was all over the place. How can he be such a dead shot with this gun that he's never lifted before? I didn't buy that side of it, I just didn't laugh. I must have been in a bad mood that day.
You must have been. I mean, to be honest, and I'm not trying to like pull rank or anything here. I mean, could it just simply be a cultural thing? Is it the British sense of humour is more attuned to laughing at toilet jokes?
There's a lot of good British comedy. I don't think so. I was thinking about it afterwards, and it's a bit similar to what we're just saying with Hail Caesar. You had Ian McShane in there, Penelope Cruz, Rebel Wilson. They didn't have a heck of a lot to do. I think Mark Strong, who plays the brother, I thought he did a good job with what he was given. I quite enjoyed his performance. I just thought Sacha Baron Cohen, I don't know, didn't seem to be giving it his all. It's the best way I could put it. It just felt, didn't feel like it was... not there for me.
I felt he, although like I said, I did laugh much of the way through it. I did have one huge problem with it.
Ah, okay.
And as you mentioned earlier, his accent was all over the place. And of course it was. And that's what happens anytime you get a posh southern git trying to play a northerner. It's, frankly, it's the linguistic equivalent of blacking up, and it bothers me. You mentioned Borat, and yes, he created a racial stereotype, but he did so in order to take that character and use it in a way that then drew attention to the idiocy of America. And so you have wonderful scenes like where he goes into a gun shop and asks what gun's got the best stopping power and which one can stop a Jew. And you see the Americans who buy into that kind of conversation. And so he uses the character to play other people, and you're very much punching up in a case like that. You're not simply mocking Kazakhstan. What you're doing is you're using that character to punch up against America. And anytime anyone's mocking America, I'm right behind it. I'll back them to the hilt on that one. But what he's doing here is, again, rich southern posh git has decided he's going to mock the north of England. And the north of England is not the monolithic construct that rich posh southern gits imagine it is. And so his accent wanders back and forth across the Pennines. Grimsby is a town on the east coast of England. Half the time they were referencing Manchester, which is a completely separate city in a completely different part of the country. Yeah. But if you're a southerner, you don't know that. All you know is it's grim up north. They chose Grimsby not because there's any particular significance to the town. It's because it's got the word grim in it. And you can mock the north. And you see lots of outside shots of working class housing, council estates in a grim town up north in the rain and under grey skies. It was simply an attempt to sneer and mock northerners. And I found it deeply offensive on that level. You'll remember at the end when they actually have him basically turning into Liam Gallagher out of Oasis. Again, Manchester, not Yorkshire, not Lincolnshire. It's a whole different part of the country. But if you're a southerner, you don't care. It's all just north. And I didn't like it. It was punching down. And good humour shouldn't do that. And I know at the very end, there was an attempt to redeem it with the reference to, they think we're just working class scum, but we're going to do something good. And the bottom line was, all the way through it, that's all that these characters were. They were working class scum. and having the piss taken out of him by posh Southerners. And on that level, I didn't like it. But at the same time, I was torn because I was laughing all the way through it.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, I guess that's... Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with the idea of how he... There's a stark difference, Steve, but with how he used the character of Borat to shine some light on another culture.
Yes.
I don't think he did that here at all. I don't think, not even close.
No, he used the northern characters to take the piss out of the north.
Yeah, so what he's... Yeah. No, so I'm actually... I would say, unless you're feeling like a bit of a dash of the old toilet humour, just to sort of a bit of light relief, excuse the pun, I wouldn't be bothered, actually.
I would suggest if you're going to go and see it, have a few pints of lager first. It might get the edge off.
Okay.
I'm sure Sacha Baron Cohen will be really concerned about that by now.
Oh, goodness me. All right, we shall turn our minds to music.
Yes.
Now, there is what should be a fantastic and fascinating project coming up here next month. It's all to do with the death of David Bowie. He died in January, of course, and some extremely notable musicians, local musicians, are putting together a tribute for him. It'll be called Waiting in the Sky. They include people like Eddie Rayner from Split Enz, of course, Finn Andrews from The Vales, the one-time exponent Jordan Luck, and others, Alistair Riddell, for instance, who you might... Steve, that Alistair Riddell's an interesting character because you haven't been in New Zealand years and years and years and years.
Not as long as you have, sir, no.
So there was he was in a very well-known band locally back in the 70s called Space Waltz.
Oh, yeah?
And he, with his long, straight hair... this was a band that entered a local TV talent show.
Oh yeah,
I think I got this right. And I think they won it. And they had a song called "Out on the Street," which became hugely popular. And certainly, it was that sort of a slightly glam rock, but very much in the Bowie scene that that band seemed to draw on. So it's quite appropriate that Alistair Riddell is involved in this. Now, this concert, Waiting in the Sky, it'll be performed, where are we? Auckland, Christchurch, Wellington, as I say. Steve and I are very pleased to be invited to rehearsals in Auckland just a few days ago. And Steve, you caught up with Jordan Luck.
Yes, I did. I have to say, when he walked in the room, I took one look and thought, oh my word, they've got Ron Wood. The guy does look looks a lot like him. And did a fantastic reading of Rebel Rebel. I had a chat with him about it. Let's have a listen.
Bowie reality tour, and he opened the reality tour with, 2003, I think.
Oh, yeah? So you're obviously a Bowie fan, or who isn't? Oh, yeah. Going all the way back.
Yeah, Oamaru going down into a pool hall, and up in Suffragette City, and... Gene Genie,
okay,
were the two tracks that would continue to play. And weirdly, I was just reading about Rebel Rebel, and around that same time was the Rolling Stones, I know it's only rock and roll, but
right.
I like it.
Right.
And Bowie apparently, he's going, I'm going to out Mick Mick, and that's why he wrote Rebel Rebel.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
Apparently.
Right. So if I were to ask which Bowie was your Bowie, I'm guessing we're talking the earlier stuff, yeah?
Oh gosh, because then I think I've admired him and respected everything he's done, him and the Beatles, all the way through. I guess as an influence, though, yeah, the early 70s ones. Actually, I am doing Kooks, which is from Hunky Dory. Driving Saturday from Aladdin Sane.
Right.
Rebel Rebel Diamond. It's all the 72, 74, basically, so yeah.
Yeah.
Which was actually, as I've gathered so far, out of all the material, not many of us have crossed over so far that I've noticed. We're all doing four songs each.
Right.
And I haven't heard of anyone crossing over yet.
Right. So obviously, you're a Barry fan going a long time back. When you were invited to join this production.
Entourage?
That'll do, yeah. You'll take that.
Menagerie?
Yeah, go on. We could go with this all day. What were your thoughts?
Oh, I was very excited. Yeah. I was surprised about how quickly it sounded like they had the PA and venues all together before they had an actual band or right. Yeah, come together quick. Yeah.
Fair enough. So, well, tell me about that, right? So we've got Bowie in, obviously, in heaven, waiting in the sky now, right? Put together for me your ideal band. What's Heaven's House Band looking like?
Oh, shit, man.
Put you on the spot.
Well, actually, I kind of lost a lot of friends recently. And,
I'm sorry to hear that.
There'd be people like Brazier and McCartney. And flipping, nah. Way too tricky. And anyway, I think they're still around. Like, I don't know about this bit about burying in the ground, and that's where you are, kind of. I think your spirit and your soul's about. So I often feel that people are playing with you or kind of guiding you along sometimes.
So are you feeling as sort of a helping hand when you're singing?
I believe Bowie would be around checking this sort of scenario, yeah.
Well, I tweeted about this as soon as I got the publicity about it, and I got a reply within a few hours saying, too soon. Does that make any sense?
For Mr. Bowie?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Although, I like the way it was Mozart did a, what do you call them, a funereal kind of piece, and it's almost like Bowie knew he was going and created.
That was Jordan Luck, once of the Exponents, and now part of the less creatively named Jordan Luck Band. Quite a derivative name there. Now, we were lucky to hear him sing, and we saw a couple of other performances as well. Simon, who did you talk to?
Okay, well, I'd actually spoken to Alistair Riddell once when I was with RNZ, so I was quite keen to catch up with him face-to-face. So I had a chat with him, and we did talk about his connections to Bowie way back in the 70s. Here's what he had to say.
Are you happy to chat?
Okay. Yeah, fine.
So, Crave today is at Roundhead Studios in Auckland for a rehearsal for a fantastic Bowie tribute night. I'm with Alistair Riddell. Alistair, just quickly, who's involved? Who are the main players here? And how did this come about?
It's me. Jordan Luck. I'm sorry, look, I don't know everybody's surnames.
Well, you just know them by their first names.
Yeah, I do.
Jordan and Eddie Rayner.
Eddie Rayner, Stan, Olivia, yep. And Zane Griff. So that's us. And then it was Eddie that asked me to do it. He said that they were putting together a Bowie tribute show, and people say I'm the David Bowie, New Zealand's David Bowie.
Well, they do say that, don't they?
I suppose that's a good thing.
Yeah, I think so.
So I think I was a natural choice. I got a phone call and I said yes straight away.
Do you remember hearing the news and what you felt at the time when he died?
I was shocked. I have a friend in London who told me a couple of weeks before that there was a rumour going around that he had liver cancer. And so I probably, I don't know, just strangely had a slight heads up, but I didn't think that it was coming. You know, there was the whole thing around the album,
yes.
His birthday, and sort of I was watching that thinking, oh, it's great, because I really liked the new stuff on the album.
Yeah.
And a few people were saying it was a bit odd, but I thought it was great. And it was very creative, and I thought he was really hitting his creative stride again, and then suddenly bang, he was dead. So it was shocking.
Yeah. Which song are you going to be singing in this tribute evening?
Well, they haven't cleared all the songs, but I'm going to be doing Space Oddities.
Oh, fantastic.
So that's fine. Yeah.
He came here several times. I saw him twice in Western Springs. Huge crowd. Did you ever see him live in New Zealand?
I saw him at Western Springs. Was that 77, 78?
Yes.
Yeah, and that was a great show. They called it his expressionist period. That was sort of on Low and Heroes. And,
yes.
And it was artistically and creatively, it was a fantastic show, as you know, if you were there. Later on, I never saw the Serious Moonlight tour, but he was embarrassed about that, he said. And he told some story about going onto a farm up in North Auckland and burning that spider. And he said he did it with great relish.
Okay.
So he was sick of the spider at that stage. But so I don't know what that tour was like, but he was always put on an amazing show. So
he did.
I'm sure it was.
He seems to have been, well, not seems, he was someone who just touched a lot of people's lives, as some of these big artists do.
Yes.
What was it about him that really made him stand out from others?
Well, I was right there in the very early days, to 71, I think 70, 71, when I heard Space Oddity, and that was a kind of a flash in the pan for him, and he kind of disappeared for two or three years after that. But I thought, I had a friend who was actually turned out to be a top DJ in Australia, Selwyn Jones, who's sadly passed away now. But Selwyn said, have you heard this guy? And we were at school. No, around about the time I left school anyway. And he said, I bought the David Bowie album. That was the one with Space Oddity on it. And then I heard about, so I used to get Melody Maker every week, and I heard about Man Who Sold the World, and I ordered a copy from the UK. So, and that was about the time, about 2 weeks after that I met Eddie. So we had a band called Orb, and we were doing my songs, but we did a smattering of the songs off that album. So, he was a big influence on me. I'd be, untruthful to say he wasn't, but what I liked about it was that I was into the theatricality of Tony Newley, and he was, everything he was doing was like, this guy's like ahead of me, it felt like that, he was older, but it was just, I just resonated completely with what he was doing. So I got Hunky Dory, and then got that from overseas as well.
Yeah, all right.
And slowly, it was a slow build-up, because I don't really think that he became a global phenomenon until around about the Let's Dance time. So
that was his big commercial period.
It was a really long, steady growth.
Yeah.
But it's an amazing talent. Sort of almost a once-in-a-lifetime. Not quite, but, it's amazing anyway.
Thanks very much, Alistair.
Thank
Great
you, Simon.
To have a chat to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that was Alistair Riddell, very much into the the David Bowie idea of a tribute. By the way, he also wanted to talk to me, Steve, about the death just a few days ago of George Martin, the fifth Beatle. For him, he's a little bit older than me, and he thought that was a huge, huge event, by the way. So just wanted to acknowledge that. A couple of other people
Just in case anyone's not keeping up with this, that's George Martin, the record producer,
indeed.
George R.R. Martin, the writer of Game of Thrones. There has been confusion about this on the internet.
Oh, you're right. There has too.
Apparently, George R.R. Martin has had to, as they say, take to Twitter. That's what one does. He's taken to Twitter to make sure that people know that, don't worry, guys, it's not me that's dead. And the most astonishing thing is people have been relieved that it was George Martin. Which is horrible. But anyway.
Isn't it? It's terrible.
It's a shocking response. But moving back to back to Bowie and the like. You were saying.
No, not at all. So just a couple of other people I caught up with as well. A very accomplished Australian singer, Olympia, and also Zane Grif, who had quite a bit to say about the influence of David Bowie.
How much did he sort of, was he someone on your landscape?
Well, you grow up with him on Smooth FM or hit stations, with other anthems that are really popular and mainstream. However, with Bowie, there is so much more to the music. There's so much more complexity. You're never oversaturated, Like, I'm trying to, I don't want to name other artists' songs that you like. If I hear that song one more time, actually, maybe April Sun in Cuba. I think I've heard that song enough times. But, no, I love Dragon. I take it back.
We're sidelining ourselves, but here.
They're Kiwis.
Yeah.
And I was sort of just saying, stepping into the songs, I've never sort of just taking in the artistry, the you know, the lyrics, the song range, like vocal talent, you know, all the people that he's worked with. It's incredibly inspiring and motivating. I honestly still don't think it's possible. And every documentary I see and all the footage, and you would know because you've worked with him, I just think, how is that possible? How could he go into a room and say, I want that person, or I want to try this? It blows my mind. I guess, especially in a contemporary context, I'm not sure whether we'll ever see a David Bowie again.
I've got Finn here with me too. What's your opinion on that, Finn?
Zane,
sorry. I'll do that again. Zane's with us as well. Zane, what's your opinion about, could there be another Bowie, someone like Bowie as influential and as trend-setting as him?
We'll have to wait and see. I'm pretty uncertain about that. He comes from a long line of people before him who influenced him. And that we've lost those people too, you know. So he was highly inspired by even Anthony Newley and many English playwrights and actors. And he's got, you know, where he comes from, the bottom of his pit is a long time ago. And yeah, I don't know, the influence. How can we influence the new ones coming through? What are they listening to? It'd be interesting to talk to the younger ones.
And being involved in a tribute like this, how personally satisfying is that going to be for you?
It's going to be interesting for me emotionally, because having spent time with him and working with him in London and remembering certain things about him in the studio particularly, it's going to be a bit strange on stage, I think.
I read your interview where you said he records in one take.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. So it's crazy.
So what happened was, when I was when we're getting his songs together, he actually sat cross-legged on the floor with a 12-string, and he played the songs we were about to do, and we as a band put down the backings with him singing a guide, you know, in the other booth, and then we then laid down the backing track. He went back into the control room and said, Tony, I want to do a vocal. He laid down about 8 bars of music, vocally. And then he did one take on all the tracks. I've never ever done or come anywhere near that.
No.
He was unbelievably emotional when he sang. But to do it in one delivery, it's real professionalism. So he was well versed. He was well rehearsed before he got there. Didn't waste any time.
How does he have all that time?
He's just so passionate. He was so passionate.
The David Bowie Appreciation Society is now...
Well, another thing, though, that I was thinking, why I feel like we won't have another David Bowie commercially, he made so many incredible albums. By the time he put out Let's Dance, apparently a lot of his followers thought, oh, you've sold out.
Yes, absolutely. I can remember that at the time, yeah.
I was thinking, wow, that's... But he had the opportunity to create albums that were sort of art for art, or, I mean, I think that they're incredible, but that they were so left field. I don't know. If, you know,
I think his success was off risk. He did put himself on that side of the wall, you know. He jumped the fence, you know. He did try to go a little straight there, which he hated.
Yeah.
His avant-garde blend, if you like, was like the low the Heroes albums, you know. Yeah. He always had a bent to everything, particularly the people he plucked to work with. Yeah. The sound, he want that sound, he got that sound. I want that sound, I got that sound.
Fantastic. Yeah. Thank you both very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
And also taking part in Waiting in the Sky, you've mentioned Eddie Rayner. We've also got Finn Andrews of the Vales, who unfortunately wasn't at the rehearsal session that we attended, because apparently he's got, you know, many, many commitments. You know, so many things going on. It's terrible.
Yeah.
And also a particular favourite of mine, a chap by the name of Skyscraper Stan.
And his name is completely appropriate to his stature.
It is rather, isn't it? Yes. There's not many people that you and I both have to look up to.
No, correct.
Anyway. Lovely chap as well. Lovely chap. Yes. And we will be getting him on the show as soon as possible. He's a very nice bloke. And he will be singing... I forget, he did tell me, and I should have written it down. He did, but it's an interesting structure to the show, just to mention this. If I remember correctly, it's Eddie Rayner who was the brains behind the whole thing, who started pulling people together, and they asked all the different participants which songs you'd be interested in performing to assemble a set list, and they're all asked to put together four songs. And apparently, basically, the same five or six songs kept on occurring from absolutely every performer.
Right.
Everybody wanted to do the same few. And obviously, Let's Dance was up there. Obviously, Space Oddity. And we... If I could...
Rebel Rebel, Young Americans.
Yeah, oh yes, we got to hear Young Americans being played, and that was astonishing. Olympia singing Life on Mars was spine-tingling.
Yep.
It's going to be quite a remarkable show.
And a great band. I thought they sounded... We were just in a rehearsal studio, but I thought they sounded really, really good.
They were tight, weren't they?
Very nice, very nice. So it's called Bowie Waiting in the Sky. It'll be in Auckland at the ASB Theatre on April the 15th. The next night in Wellington, the 16th, at the St. James Theatre. And then on April the 19th in Christchurch, the Isaac Theatre Royal.
Yeah, we'll have full ticketing details, of course. I recommend that you get tickets for this one. You can find full ticketing details at our website, cravepodcast.com. Strongly recommend you look into it.
Not your mother.
Steve, what else is coming up soon, by the way?
Another strong recommendation is to get yourself down to the King's Arms in Auckland, if you happen to be in town, on the 24th of March to see Swamp Thing. I've talked about these fellas before. They're just drums, guitar and vocals, two chaps, Michael and Grant, but it's some of the best and, I have to say, some of the filthiest guitar, rock and blues that you'll hear. They are very entertaining. Amazing drumming, amazing guitar playing, bluesy, rocky, fantastic. Can't speak highly enough of them. For something a little bit more mainstream but still very bluesy, Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac fame.
Mick Fleetwood, him.
Him, yes, that Mick Fleetwood.
Okay.
Yes. Didn't Fleetwood Mac play in Auckland last year?
Yeah, that long ago.
Exactly. He clearly liked it because he's coming back.
Fantastic.
Mick Fleetwood of Fleetwood Mac fame, there you go. He's also playing the ASB Theatre in Auckland. He'll be there on the 31st of March. And then, because these guys are troopers, he's going straight down to Wellington the next day, and he'll be at Wellington's Opera House on the 1st of April.
Good stuff, good stuff. By the way, we seem to be, what's the word I'm looking for? International recognition has come our way, Steve. I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but if you've been to the movies lately, I'm just changing tack here, Steve, very, very cleverly.
It's seamless. Nobody will ever notice that little segue.
Unsubtly. There's been some trailers going around for New Zealand comedy by Taika Waititi called The Hunt for the Wilder People. And there's a trailer that I've seen it a couple of times now. And at the end of the trailer, there are some quotes from various reviewers. I think this film's been at various festivals overseas. And the first quote, extolling how wonderful this film is from someone called Crave.
This is shocking. This is dreadful. This is unacceptable.
Well, when I saw that, I thought you'd been moonlighting off overseas, Steve, and you'd been to Berlin or Vienna or somewhere. Or
I mean, I'm glad you understand that my dedication to this podcast knows no bounds. But no, it's altogether more sinister. Somebody's clearly trying to cash in on our international fame and glory.
Yeah, exactly.
It's atrocious.
It is atrocious. I'm slighted.
Intolerable.
Speaking of cashing in, just quickly, you know, the other week you and I really enjoyed and said so the latest take on the superhero genre, Deadpool.
Yes, indeed.
Well, I just was interested to see how well that film was doing. It has now made $680 million around the world.
$680 million.
From a production budget of just $58 million. Now, that's not a bad return.
That's not shabby, is it? First of all, I have to be honest, I'm amazed they made that film for such a small budget.
I guess that is interesting in itself, you're right. It looked like it was quite a big budget film.
It is. It's a very, very special effects-y heavy film. But that's an amazing return. It does, to be fair, reflect what a good film it is.
Yeah, so I think what this really shows is you and I are finally attuned to the natural pulse of the movie-going public around the world.
What you're trying to say is we finally know what we're talking about.
Exactly, thank you.
It's taken a while, but we're getting there. People should actually start to listen to us now.
Yeah, see, where we go, the public follows. So what else can I tell you?
Absolutely.
Anyway, look, that's enough ranting and raving. There's a lot coming up. We look forward to talking to you again very soon. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd be very pleased to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Obviously, we're on Facebook, because who isn't? And also, you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
We look forward to chatting to you again very soon. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
That's what's been entertaining us this week.
Outstanding. 1, 2, 3, 4.
It's amazing the difference between rehearsal when there's nobody here and you've got like a couple of people watching.
Where's John? Gone home.